Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hey, everyone. Happy back end of the schedule that isn't quite as crazy as the middle of the schedule week.
Yeah. I mean, granted, like, it's kind of just as bad, if not worse, if only because, and I know Hoya Sucks talked about this, and we talked about this in the podcast last week, but the big issue now is that no game is an assured loss, but also no game is an assured win. So in some ways, it's twice as terrifying and just as thrilling in others.
Yeah, I guess it's not as scary, like, brand-wise. Like, we you know, we have Wake Forest and BC with Louisville in between. And honestly, like, Louisville's probably the biggest mess of those three teams, but they still have, like, a Heisman-winning quarterback. BC is just this weird, like, enigma that's picked it up out of nowhere recently, and Wake is just this not super talented but very consistent team that's played very well this year. So it's not quite the easy finish we thought we had, but I think I would still rather take my chances with, like, even a hot BC or a Wake Forest over a very talented if inconsistent Florida State.
Yeah, I'd have to agree there. I think, you know, a lot of us have been kind of talking about this in the comments, on Twitter, Slack, what have you. Like, at this point, you'll still take your chances with BC and Wake, but, like, some people think Louisville might be more winnable because of the defense. I tend to doubt it. I do think that Wake having their number one wide receiver out for the rest of the season is helpful. But, I knew John Wolford was having a really good season, but I didn't realize how good it was until I looked last night. Like, what happened to the Wake offense where suddenly they're just, like, I wouldn't say efficient because that's not the word, but they're suddenly effective at the very least?
Yeah, well, Walford's definitely had a really nice season. Obviously, he's bolstered by they had a huge week. Who did they play last week? Oh, the Louisville game. They lost Notre Dame last week, but the Louisville game, and he played pretty well against Notre Dame too, but Louisville, I think he had, what, like, 5 touchdowns? I'm pulling it up now. 461 and 5 touchdowns against that, like, really, really porous Louisville defense in a 42-32, I think they were at home win. I mean, I think that's, like Walford's a nice quarterback. That is kind of what you get with the Louisville defense this year. They are just really, really dreadful. But at the same time, like, Wake Forest, this is definitely the best offense they fielded in, I mean, I don't remember since before we were in the ACC, for sure.
Maybe further back. Like, to be honest, like, even when guys like Tanner Price were at the height of their powers, I don't necessarily think Wake was all that good, like, from an offensive perspective. Like, I can track back a little bit, but I think this is somehow one of the more dynamic, like, offenses Wake's ever had.
Who's their, I should know this, who's their offensive coordinator now?
I have no idea.
This is, like, a pretty solid turnaround, and obviously I think they've like, aged up some guys. Like, Matt Colburn's been there for a while. Obviously, John Wolford, now that he's done getting killed every single game, is, you know, been healthy and is a senior.
Obviously, they just lost Warren Ruggiero. Who is
that? Is that even a real person? It sounds like a made up.
Sounds like a made up, like, offensive, like, Italian stereotype coach that would coach on Adazio's staff.
He definitely went to Southern Connecticut because, you know,
of course,
every Italian football coach from Connecticut, you know, ended up coaching in some weird private school in the East Coast at some point. I will be interested to see how they rebound from. I think Greg Dortch was he out last game?
I think he was injured last week, but yeah, now he's just out.
I don't know if they'll have him. I don't know if they've released their injury report yet.
He's done for the season.
Okay. Yeah, so he is by far their best receiver, freshman out of Richmond. He had 722 yards and 9 touchdowns, pretty big, some big play potential. I'm looking at Bill C. has the rundown here. He had 74 targets on the year. The next highest guy was Donnie Washington with 43. His 54 catches is more than twice what anyone else had. By far the most touchdown. Cam Serene is still there, too. Like, come on. Like, Cam Serene, their tight end, who has 5 touchdowns, red zone threat. Like, I feel like he's been there for
decades.
Since I was, like, since we were playing them in, like, non-conference play. Cortez Lewis is still kicking around. Like, a lot of these names that you've probably seen before, even if they weren't like huge impact players, are just, they've just been there for a while. So this is what you get when you have a veteran laden group. So they're that's what I said before, like they're very consistent. They play their game. They're not super talented like Florida State. They don't have Cam Akers running around, but they're going to execute well. They seem to be consistent throughout the game. Looking at their situational numbers, they do kind of fall down in the fourth quarter a bit, but pretty balanced throughout the game. Otherwise, their defense is still pretty good. So it's going to be tough. Like it's not going to be a team that beats itself. I'm very glad this one's at the Dome because we clearly do play better there.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's a godsend here. Yes, we'd be able to make a bowl game by losing all the road games if necessary. I'd rather not get into that situation, however. I think that playing at home, not playing in hurricane conditions like we did last year, the familiar crowd, I think, just seems to do, you know, some more favors for maybe the defense in particular. I just feel like they get a little more amped up. They're a little more focused early on in the game. Obviously, there's, you know, some bits and pieces there that aren't, but I think, too, I feel like Dungy just runs better on turf. He still runs really well, and you've seen him, you know, rack up over 100 yards in, like, a few of the last few games. So it's not a question of his ability to produce. It's just a question of, like, I feel like he more safely produces on the Dome turf, if that makes sense.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. It's a faster field than what we get, you know, a lot of the road venues in the ACC. And it just seems like the crowd has, you know, even when it's small, it has been pretty good in terms of the energy that they give the team. I'm interested to see what I hate being like, I try to like make myself not care about the turnout. I'm interested to see what the effect is of, the first game since the Clemson game, which feels like so long ago, but
yeah, I think the buzz is worn off.
Two losses, which kind of dampens it, which is tough because there were two, like, you know, their losses you would probably put in Penn early before the year. They had a chance to win both because this is Syracuse, so they have a chance to win every single game, and they, you know, are very, they try to find ways to make it as frustrating as possible.
More and more creative ways to lose each week.
Yes. And you can see it, like, we're coming so close in all of these games. It actually reminds me, it's like the bizarro version of Doug Marrone's first year, where pretty much every game was close. I think they covered the spread, like, we're really good in the spread this year. I don't know the exact record, but I think we're maybe 7-2?
We're 6-1-1.
Okay, 6-1-1. I think Marrone's first year we were like 8-4 or something like that. I can go look it up, but I'm not sure how far back the like odd shark numbers go. But that tends to pay dividends in the future. I mean, not the gambling aspect of it, but teams that cover the spread a lot that are under 500 one year tend to kind of turn into, like, you can see the progress made the next year in the actual record. So hopefully that's the case here. But, I mean, this team's in every single game. I'm not sure what the line is on this game. I think Wake is probably a pretty slight favorite.
It started 3.5 point underdogs for Wake, and now I think Syracuse is -1 at this point.
Yeah, I'm actually seeing that now. That's pretty, actually kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty much a push. I think everyone's a little concerned about Dungy's health, and that's kind of pushing the line down.
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned about Dungy's health at all times.
Well, yeah, exactly. Who isn't? Well, Dungy. Dungy isn't. Dungy would be the lone player not concerned about Dungy's health at all times.
No, Dungy might be more like, I mean, I'm terrified to know like what his like cortisone shot regimen is at this point. He's probably like more painkiller than man. But yeah, you could ask me in mid-April if I'm concerned about Dungy's health, and I'd be like, yes, absolutely.
Mets game's on. Yep, Dungy. Is Dungy gonna, you know, fall down a flight of stairs because he tried to jump? Because he tried to jump 5 of the steps at once. Definitely.
He ran to. I mean, chalkboards don't exist anymore. But in, you know, some weird world where Dungy's, you know, a student at Rushmore Prep, he like ran too fast up to the chalkboard to solve a long division problem and, you know, sprained his ankle, but also trucked 3 people. So yeah, I mean, if he's healthy and, or if he's just doing the thing where he doesn't, you know, his pain threshold doesn't matter, we'll have a chance because he's just such a ridiculous dynamic player. But this should be a really tough one. I'm worried, but again, like having it at the Dome, I think is a big difference. If this is on the road again, I think it'd be tough, especially after the nonsense at Wake last year with that ridiculous weather.
The ridiculous weather and the fact that, like, I feel like everyone looked at that score and forgot to, like, check out the box score. Like, it was not it was not a one-sided game at all. Both teams played like absolute ass, like in that weather. It's just that Syracuse moved the ball primarily, you know, through the air, and throwing in that weather is just not going to cut it. And so a couple turnovers ensued.
As Notre Dame.
Yeah, as Notre Dame could definitely attest to, the exact same day in a similar venue nearby. But yeah, we, I mean, it's not that we didn't try to run. It's that we literally just couldn't get anything with the run. So we were forced to pass, and that caused some issues. A late turnover kind of flipped the field from what was, you know, a 21-9 game to a 28-9 game. SU was driving, you know, mid fourth quarter with a chance to, I believe, tie it up or something similar. I don't recall the exact margin at the moment, but yeah, it was definitely one of those games where like the final score doesn't necessarily give you the, you know, accurate outcome or anything like that. That said, like Syracuse obviously still lost, these things happen. But there was, you know, before we kind of, I do want to talk a little bit more about the Florida State game, but before we dive into that, there were two articles today, actually, that I wanted to bring up. One of them was a point made by Julian Wiggum. He was talking about the defensive breakdown and was saying one of his biggest issues, and it was something that he saw in how the players were pursuing and how they were being, you know, not like overly aggressive, but definitely over-pursuing at times. Like, they were trying for what he, you know, referred to him as like kind of home run hits instead of kind of gradually, you know, eating away at what the offense could do. And like, you know, noting that it was a big departure from earlier in the season, and that like you saw in the Clemson game and, you know, some of the other games like LSU, that like the defense was kind of picking away. And then since the Clemson game, they got a little too confident, and they've been going for like these big, big, you know, statement plays and aggressive plays, and that's kind of led to, you know, some of these big gains. I know FSU had three touchdowns of 50 or more yards, and Miami had a couple long drives as well. So I don't know if you saw that, but I don't know also, too, Dan, if it's something that you've noticed just from watching on your end.
Yeah, I read Julian's piece right before we started here. That was pretty much like, I think the upshot of that is that that was really all Florida State got. The defense was pretty spectacular aside from those big plays, but I do think that was a good point, especially with a shifty running back like Cam Akers. He just really good, like, one cut in the hole runner.
And he's going to be horrifying in like a year.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the reasons why everyone kind of assumed Florida State would be a playoff contender this year, because you had him, you had Francois, who I think we're all big fans of when he's healthy. At quarterback, their receivers were probably more of an issue than we. I mean, we talked about this last week ahead of their that game, but we probably should have seen the receiver issue ahead of time, and the offensive line issue, which was not great last year either, as Francois would tell you, considering he got hit. He was like the Eric Dungy of Florida State. He gets hit so much. but Akers is great. Like, he's, if he had a better offensive line and a passing game that could really open things up a bit, like, he would be putting up some monster numbers as a freshman. So he'll be annoying to face for another two or three years. But yeah, the big plays were basically what gave Florida State this game the three. The long touchdown pass over the middle, which just seemed like a broken defense in the secondary.
Yeah, I think Julian mentioned the Rodney Williams kind of bit a little too far inside. You saw that on the replay too, that it was just, you know, Williams is playing mostly free safety, and he didn't move quickly enough backward, and that kind of let, you know, it wasn't even like there was a deep man over the top. Like, this was a slot guy who was just able to quickly, like, go on a seam inside and collect that pass. It was actually pretty reminiscent of what the pass that we pulled off against Florida State later in the first half, with Jamal Custis, you know, just getting completely free on the inside. Over what was a, like, kind of caught flat-footed Florida State secondary.
Yeah, I think on Custis, I'd have to rewatch it, but I'm pretty sure two defenders both jumped on the same receiver over the middle, and Custis just ran by everyone. But I have to rewatch that. But yeah, very similar plays where, like, you just found an eye directly open over the middle. I think Florida State's was a little more about, like, a guy is really fast, which is a Florida State thing.
Right.
Custis was just a total blown coverage because, like, he could not have been more open. And also, like, when Dungy, I think I tweeted this, but, like, when Dungy let the ball drop, because no one, you know, you didn't see Custis down the field, you're like, what is he doing? Yeah, why is he throwing so deep on this fourth? Oh, okay.
This is why, this is one of the many reasons why I wish we had, like, all 22 footage.
Yeah.
For college, because that would have really come in handy for me, just to, I mean, and to be honest, like, while I enjoy doing the play calling breakdowns, things like that, I would get so much more out of it, and I feel like everybody else would too, if I had that at my disposal. Because I feel like, you know, I'm making a lot of assumptions about what coverage looks like downfield when I'm talking about, you know, okay, Dungy didn't throw here. Like, I mean, like, you saw a little bit of it on the replay, but to be honest, like when Dungy against Florida State, that play that he took a sack that he never should have in a million years, you know, we make some assumptions that he could have thrown it away to somewhere or someone, or at least out of bounds. I would have liked to see, you know, the all 22 that would have shown, you know, what he really had available to him. And if he had no one, fine, but like, you had the opportunity to quickly roll out and ditch that out of bounds about 5 seconds sooner than you did. And obviously it cost Syracuse a good 15, 20 seconds. It really could have either led to a shorter field goal, or even a touchdown to win the game late.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't ideal. And you know, those are the plays that Dungy, you know, I like always hate criticizing him because he is just so important. Like, he's about as important to Syracuse as any player is in college football to their team, which is silly to say because Syracuse, you know, they're 4-5 and they're not some great team. But like, if they were forced to start Zach Mahoney every week, and we all love Mahoney, but if they were forced to start Mahoney every week, they'd be a 2-win team probably. And yeah, with Dungy, they're fighting for a bowl bid and are competing against some of the best teams in college football. So like, there are things that he can definitely work on, which is scary because like, you assume he'll improve again before next year, assuming he is still with us, which I don't know why he wouldn't be.
I think one reason, but I'm not going to mention it.
Oh God,
it's kind of morbid.
Yeah, okay. assuming he's like literally still with us and he does not die on the field, which seems to be like the unfortunate ultimate end of Eric Dungy, because the dude is just like, pardon like the bad like war complex analogies, but like, he is the most warrior like quarterback I can remember. But man, like, if he is back for a senior year, which again, there's no like intel or anything, we all assume he will be. Like, it's kind of scary to think that he could get better and make better decisions and be more efficient and hopefully have a running game and an offensive line that's a bit more equipped to supplement him. And then we can really see, like the numbers he's putting up already are crazy. Just imagine, like, with all of those improvements. And obviously he's going to lose Steve Ishmael and Aaron Phillips, which hurts. But you hope that some other guys take a step forward. And then, you know, we'll really see what he can do in this offense, even beyond, like, this, you know, fun and entertaining, but still like pretty inefficient and kind of madcap version of Dungy we have right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this kind of got talked about because people were saying something about DeVito potentially playing, and I please know, and it's no knock on DeVito. It's just talking like necessity. It's not necessary at all. But, you know, it was talking about kind of, you know, how the depth chart shifts over the next couple of years and how that kind of lines up really well for everybody. And, like, you look at this year right now, like, we'd only lose one offensive lineman for next year. We'd lose our top two receivers, but we do have a lot of wide receivers. And I think that's something, like, folks aren't as focused on. Like, while we're not seeing huge numbers from guys like, you know, Sherrod Johnson, who really hasn't played a ton, or Nyheim Johnson, or even, like, you know, Devin Butler, who, like, plays here and there, or Jamal Custis would be a senior next year, like, we see some plays from those guys, like them, Sean Riley, some of the other guys who redshirted this year, then Cameron Jordan, those guys, and Russell Thompson Bishop in particular, all those guys are going to be ready to go next year, to go with what should be an improved offensive line. They're going to have Aaron Roberts back. I don't know if you end up seeing, like, the freshmen come in and start right away. I would think not, no matter how good Tyrone Sampson is. But having all those guys available should mean a better offensive line. I think the running game should be improved next year. Dungy under center with all of those, like, and this is what I was trying to get at with you know, folks I was talking to about, you know, why no DeVito this year or next year. It's because, like, your strengths need to be able to balance out your weaknesses a little bit. Now, next year's defense is going to be, you know, other than the linebacker position, which I think is still going to be all right, but might take a slight step back, is going to be able to be enhanced by what should be a veteran and, again, much improved secondary and defensive line. On the offensive side, the offensive line is going to be very, very experienced and healthy again. You're going to have skill position players kind of moving up and balancing out, you know, to make up for the losses of, you know, Steve Ishmael and Irvin Phillips. Dungy will obviously be a senior. But then you look at the next year, offensive line is still going to be experienced the following season, and he'll have, you know, I'd say, you know, if he's not already ready next year, a game ready Tyrone Sampson. And based on, to be honest, based on, and this isn't to knock him too much, but like I saw Aaron Servais got like some like pregame credit for like being a standout guy, and like he's played well considering like center really wasn't his natural position. He's tasked to do a lot for a redshirt freshman, but like I wouldn't call him the standout of the offensive line. I could see Tyrone Sampson definitely challenging him potentially next year. I know one of my biggest issues of late with Servais' play, while he's cut down on the penalties and things, the low snaps are absolutely killing this offense. And I mentioned that in the play calling breakdown, that like you started seeing the low snaps as early as like the late first quarter this time around. And like last game, it only started about halfway through. This game, it was pretty constant throughout, and it really hurts Dungy's ability to make a quick read. And it's resulting in him getting hit a whole lot more.
Yeah, low snaps are an issue, especially with an offense that's kind of by necessity, like very just fast releases, quick first read throws, because there just isn't very much time for Dungy. And if you have a low snap and it, you know, you have to take your eye off, you know, your receivers downfield, and then get like reposition the throw, like it's probably like a half second, which is a ton in terms of, you know, time to get the ball out. There's also a chance that Servais has moved over, which, because we have Sampson coming in, if not next year, then the year after. But the larger point's really good, because when Dungy is gone in 2 years, you'll have, you know, assuming he takes over and wins the job, you'll have a sophomore, redshirt sophomore DeVito, but you'll have a receiving core that was able to be groomed with Dungy last year with a lot of sophomores and juniors. You'll have a very experienced offensive line, maybe the most experienced unit on the team. So then you have, you know, you can plug in a young, inexperienced quarterback, but he'll have a lot of guys around him who are kind of ready to go. And that'll also be important, because I you know, we haven't watched DeVito play at the college level. He's not a, like, super mobile quarterback. I think he's athletic, but he's not Dungy, who's, you know, running around all over the place. So I don't think DeVito would work in quite the, I don't want to call it a style of play, but whatever you want to call
this
it.
Brand of offense.
Does this year. Yeah, the brand of offense, which is just like...
let Dungy do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most of the Syracuse offense is like fun, and also you can just play yakety sacks behind their highlights all the time. DeVito is going to need more of a clean pocket and a little more of like a standard offense, I think. So having a very veteran offensive line and some receivers who are kind of learning their roles and have a year of experience after, you know, Ishmael and Phillips are gone will be very helpful. So things do kind of work. They seem to be leading themselves towards working out well in that regard. Obviously there are transfers and players leaving the game and everything else, but based on how the depth chart shakes out now, I'm pretty bullish on the direction that we're going.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And then, like I said, that's kind of, I was just getting at, it wasn't to knock DeVito. It wasn't to knock anybody else, just to say like, Let the vision come together, and remember that, like, as much as guys like Ishmael and Phillips and, you know, Dungy and others are putting up big numbers here, like, this is still a team that largely has been growing all at once and at the same, like, and they're guys who are coming from the exact same place, which is, like, a disjointed, god-awful offense under the previous regime, and these guys have been able to quickly kind of pick up what Babers wanted to do. But they're, you know, they're doing it together, and they're all kind of aging out of it at the same time, you know, give or take a year. So, you know, having a little more staggered growth and staggered depth in the coming years is actually going to help us out a ton. And you're going to see the fruits of that, you know, going forward. And the fact that we're, you know, 4-5 and could technically be 9-0 without like a huge amount of stretching. But again, that assumes the luck bounce goes your way every time, and that rarely happens. I'd say that this is really great progress, and it kind of tracks back to what Babers was saying in the teleconference today, when he was talking about, you know, the fact that they've been in every game, the fact that they're able to really, you can see the results compared to last year when they were getting blown out by better opponents. And now you're seeing, you know, there is no opponent head and shoulders above Syracuse. And part of that obviously is because, you know, ACC offenses took a step back. A lot of players went to the NFL draft the last couple of years. I'd say defenses have gotten better across the board in the ACC too, but in general, like, you just don't have like a 4-5 team upper class right now. I think it's more like 2-3 at best. That's a factor as well, and that's something that Syracuse is going to have to rectify next year. When some of those teams that took a slight step back take a huge step forward next year. But in general, like, this team is competitive, and they were competitive not just against ACC programs, but against, you know, LSU as well, who's a top 25 team. So, you know, you and me and most of the other people who've been on the Babers train since day one, like, have preached progress and have preached patience. I think this is the type of year, and obviously it'd be great to end it with a bowl game. This is the type of year that I think folks who are still on the fence needed to really buy in.
Yeah, I'm a little worried that if we miss a bowl, you're going to have, like, a lot of the, you know, backlash over not finishing strong and having all these close losses. But, like, it's really hard not to appreciate just how much better the team is as a whole. And I see, like, every week when we, you know, do have these close losses, like, there are definite gripes about, like, Babers. Obviously, you could complain about the field goal at the end of the half or the not taking the field goal at the end of the half. I honestly, like, didn't mind that as much as a lot of people, just because I think you kind of have to have your process. And
Babers, and we almost had Irvin Phillips, if it went out for the tip ball at the line, Irvin Phillips would have had a wide-open touchdown on third down.
Yeah, so, like, you have to kind of separate process from results sometimes, especially with a team like this. And, you know, if they score the touchdown there, they probably win the game. There are individual play calls that I think you can gripe with. I thought he had, you know, not hit, I don't think Babers had a great coaching game in Florida State, but, like, the overall direction of the program, it's like, it's pretty inarguable that things are moving in a definitive right direction, maybe even a little quicker than we thought, even if the wins aren't there every week. And like you said, like, it's not, like, the greatest excuse, but, like, this team could be 6-3 or 7-2 if they, you know, finish a little better, or, you know, one or two big plays in a given loss. So we'll see. I mean, I think if anything, we're just need that last little push of learning to finish games versus, like, learning how to play a complete game, which is coming along probably quicker than, you know, just hitting, like, a couple of big lucky players and getting some wins that we didn't earn, or not being a team that's as good as our record.
Yeah.
Or we just schedule easier.
Or just schedule easier, and that works. I mean, hey, look at well, I guess they're not really a good example anymore. But I know I mentioned this in the Slack room. I was watching CBS Sports, and they were talking about the biggest stories of the year. And for some reason, one of the biggest stories was Rutgers being 3-3 in the Big Ten. Sure, whatever.
Good for them. They're beating they're beating their peer group, which is what they need to do. Improve.
But, like,
Chris Ash has done a nice job. Like, it's not.
Oh,
I would take Babers over him, but, you know, good for Rutgers. They're winning home games and they're beating their peer programs, I did not expect.
And like, this isn't even to, like, you know, deride Rutgers. Like, I wrote about them for the comeback, like, back in September, about how you could see, like, you know, the seeds of getting better, like, being sown against, like, even, like, Washington. But I just found it weird that, like, of all the things that you could harp on is, like, the storyline for the 2017 season. Like, it's, like, the coolest storylines or, like, the nicest storylines. Like, a 3-3 Rutgers team that beat up on its peer group and is getting smoked by, like, the elites of the Big Ten. I don't really know if that's, like, anywhere near the top of my list.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't be, like, the first thing I gravitated to, even in the Big Ten. But, you know, it's something, I guess. I guess this was our being nice to Rutgers segment of the season.
Enjoy it. This is your only hope.
For all those Rutgers fans that listen to this podcast on a weekly basis, I don't know who you are.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a few of you that are just looking for that glimmer of disrespect. Rutgers and UConn fans have that in common, and Penn State fans too. Where, you know,
I actually wouldn't be surprised if UConn fans listen to this, just in case, you know, we bring up the realignment. It's been a little bit.
It has been a little bit. We're not going to talk about that today. But if anyone has, like, audio SEO, they everything just went up on, like, red alert.
Oh, definitely put it in the URL.
I'm going to put it in the URL for sure.
Conference realignment, UConn, ACC.
Honestly, like, I always feel like them, Rutgers, and, like, Penn State, too, and just have, like, Google alerts for any time anyone says something about them, anytime anyone tweets about them. Like, there's just, like, they just get, like, a summary every hour of, like, the, you know, the disrespect chronicles. Clemson does, too, but to a different extent. Like, Clemson only cares about, like, the big fish and who's saying stuff about them. Like, the other three, like, Penn State, like, they'll go after you. They'll go after, like, a 5-follower, like egg account. Who says something about, you know, Penn State, and they just respond with, like, we are, like, 50 goddamn times. It's like, God forbid.
It's not wrong.
You are. I mean, that's true.
Should also put this in. But in the slug, after, you know, UConn, Conference Realignment, ACC,
Penn
Big
State
10,
disrespect.
Joe Paterno statue, Penn State College Football Playoff.
Does Penn State even belong in the top 25? Discuss. Good Lord. Anyway, that's a good excuse to talk about some beer, Dan. So what have you been drinking?
I had a pretty good week for some new stuff. I went down to the Philadelphia area for a day to visit friends. I had the Blueberry Berliner Weiss from Conshohocken Brewing, which is really good, a nice Berliner Weiss sour. The blueberry flavor is not, like, crazy. My friend gave it to me from a growler. I couldn't even, like, quite guess what the fruit was because it's definitely more of a sour than, like, the distinct, like, blueberry beer flavor. But it's very good. I went to Iron Hill Brewery, which is just one of those, like, chain breweries that you get so off, you know, see in different areas. This one's in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, one of those dad brewery type things.
Right, and I honestly didn't expect very much, but I had a Citra IPA from them, and it was actually really good, which was nice, very drinkable. Just a solid IPA, but usually I feel like those places, like, their IPAs are pretty crappy, and this one wasn't. This was, like, a really solid IPA, so no complaints there. I have a growler of Single Cut Softly Spoken Magic Spells in my fridge, which I, you know, have every so often. It's one of their signatures. I always kind of forget how much of, like, a powerhouse this thing is. It's 8.6%. It's, like, a really, like, it packs a real punch for a double IPA, but very delicious. And then I had a Second Fiddle from Fiddlehead Brewing, which is, I think that was another double. Yeah, really big. Probably not on the same level as the Softly Spoken, but another big good double IPA from Fiddlehead Brewing. I had a Super Session IPA from Lawson's Finest Liquids up in Vermont, which is really delicious. And then one of the better ones I had this week, a Yeah Buddy from Kings County Brewers here in New York. Another double IPA, also at 8.6%. This thing was, like, really delicious. I'm actually kind of surprised it's as alcoholic and as it is, because it really was, like, for a double, super drinkable. So really enjoyed that. I hadn't had that before, but Kings County does some good work.
I was trying to see if I've had anything from them.
They're fairly, I think they've kind of come on the scene recently. They're a pretty small outlet, but I think they're over in Brooklyn. But everything I had from them is pretty solid. This is actually apparently a collaboration with Finback, which is another New York City brewery.
Yeah, I was wondering if I'd had anything from them on my whirlwind tour of the boroughs when I was there, you know, twice back in March, but apparently not.
I've really noticed them a lot in the last, like, 6 months. I didn't know a lot about them before that. I don't know if they can their stuff. If they do, I might have to send you something.
Yeah, definitely about that. So I drank way too much last weekend, like, entirely too much, and I'll readily admit that. On Friday, I was over at Abigail Brewing, just like I've mentioned them before, the restaurant / brewery that's down in Hermosa. Had Suds of Anarchy, their latest New England style pale ale. I stopped at one of my favorite spots, Mediterraneo, for a happy hour. It's buy one, get one drafts. So Blind Pig had quite a few of those. Swung over to another spot for some Alesmith Tower 12. Had from Brewery Tarot, The Wanderer, which is a Flanders. Had Oat Tart with raspberries as well. Then stopped over at Select Beer Store in South Redondo. Had a Maine Beer Company gets out here occasionally, so actually had a pint of Peeper Ale from Maine Beer Co.
Oh, jealous. Yeah. I haven't had Maine in a bit.
Yeah, that was the first time I had them since last summer when lunch randomly showed up out here.
That's pretty fun. There's, like, a couple places where I can reliably get Maine, but I haven't been to those spots recently. But they're definitely one of the best places up here.
Yeah, Aaron told me that their stuff gets to Whole Foods a bunch. At least they used to, the bottle.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Whole Foods usually does a good job of, like, the, like, randomly distributed stuff. But what else did I have? Oh, I had, and I sent you a photo of this. I had the Imperial Mexican Biscotti cake break.
Yeah, I saw that. You found that out all the way out there?
Yeah, Evil Twin gets out here pretty often.
Oh, I forgot that was... Yeah, okay. I was actually mixing that up with the Mexican cake.
Yeah, this was the... Because this was the Evil Twin Westbrook collab.
Okay, it's a collaboration. Evil Twin, I feel like, is deading all over the place. Like, I found them in a lot of random spots, like when I've been outside the city.
Yeah, they're hooked up, them and a bunch of other places. Like, I feel like they've really ramped up their distro lately. Because I know, like, Grimm is out here all the time, too.
That's pretty interesting, because Grimm is, like, not the easiest thing to find even here. Obviously, you can find it if you go to a good place, but it's not like Grimm is, like, super, like, in every store. So, it's interesting that their distribution's as wide as it is, but, you know, they're doing a nice job.
Very weird.
Also, I'm not even sure if they have a brew like a tap room yet. I know they hadn't, like, when I first found them.
I think they do now.
I need to look that up, because I want to go there.
I would definitely look that up. Since I kept drinking, because, you know, liver damage is fun. Let's see. At Smog City, I had their new Coast Rider IPA. It was a passion fruit IPA. It was kind of good. I went over to Monkish and had a bunch of different things. I had a Fly Banjo, their double IPA. Well, one of their double IPAs they had on. I had a Red Hop Pale Ale. Had a Really Real Batch 2, was another double IPA. They had Wise Wordsmith, which, again, another double IPA they had on draft. Doubled back around for Fly Banjo because it was so good. Had a couple sours from them, including Interstellar Hitchhiker. And then closed out a Sunday that I drank way too much on with a bottle of Confuzzled from Celador, a beer I've mentioned before here in a brewery that I always speak very highly of.
Very nice. I'm looking at it. I still don't know if Grimm has it, because I found their address in New York, and if you like Google Maps it, it's just a random for-rent building, although this was from 2014, so they might actually be there now. But their website doesn't have anything about a new tap room, so... Yeah. I have to see. I know they like, apparently they started brewing out of, like, their kitchen, or at least they developed the beers in their kitchen, so. It's interesting that they, again, like, it's weird that they are so, like, they get out there so much, because they are very much like a, you know, mom-and-pop shop in terms of how they make their beers.
Yeah, they're, I think they go the gypsy route. I know Evil Twin does, too, even though they have Torst, which is technically a tap room.
Evil Twin brews out of Two Roads up in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Which is another really good brewery.
That it is. I have been.
It's a good time. I like that place. I haven't been there in a bit because I don't get home as much as I do, used to, but I need to get back up there too.
Fair enough. Dan, redirecting to football. Let's talk a little bit about the Wake Forest game, and then we can kind of close out with the basketball chat. Because, yes, the season is starting on Friday.
Weird.
It's always such a different vibe for basketball starting when football is actually, like, watchable. Because I'm just not ready to, like, I'm not ready to flip the switch yet. And I like to resist. And how we run the site also lets me kind of resist because I sort of run things, obviously, on the football side. And then while I talk about basketball, I do let other people do the majority of that. And I'll jump back in, like, once, you know, I get to basketball season. But I do think that, and I know, like, you're this way to an extent, like, and a lot of other people are too. Like, if I'm going to follow a season to the extent I cover and follow Syracuse football, I can't really pay attention to any other thing going on. And it gets very, very difficult to keep my eye on Syracuse basketball and football at the same time to the same, at least, level of, like, giving a shit.
I think it's, for me, it's that, like, college football starts at such a definitive point. Like, week one is such a big deal.
Right.
And there's no exhibition games to start, and it's just like, oh, college football's here, this build-up's been coming. And college basketball just kind of, like, gently pops onto the radar. I know they have, like, their big, like, 24 hours on ESPN and, like, their big matchups early. Are they not doing that this year?
They didn't do that this year, which is stupid, because I feel like the 24-hour thing, there's no way that, like, I mean, unless it's just, like, because they cut so much cost-wise, that, like, the resources needed to get that many crews and that many resources around the country might have been difficult. But, like, there's only really, like, one big matchup all weekend, and it's the Friday night that no one will care about game between, like, A&M and West Virginia.
I thought that the fact that the cursed UCLA-Georgia Tech game in China was, like, I was like, oh, that's at 11:30. That's truly part of the 24-hour college basketball tip-off thing.
Nope, just
But apparently that's just a game at 11:30 that, like, half of each team isn't playing in. For various scandals. I mean, it just, like, comes in, and especially for Syracuse, like, we never have that first huge game. We're always, like, playing, you know, not complaining about the schedule. I'm just saying, like, we don't tend to schedule ourselves those, like, huge tip-offs. We have, like, you know, Albany or something.
Like, 2 weeks later, we'll do one of the other tournaments.
Yeah, we do it, like, a week or two in. So like college basketball, like just kind of like gently comes into my life, and like I'll watch all the games, but it's not like, you know, a football game where even if you're opening with Wagner or whatever, like, oh, it's college football, it's been gone for so long, like it's this big event.
Right.
And I'm not sure how you fix that, because college basketball starts at such a weird time, because it's right in the middle of college football season, like the biggest part of college football season. And this year the NBA has already started. Obviously that's not usually the case. And the NFL is still going. So it's kind of a hard spot to like really make a dent. And college basketball is just like not a huge sport for those who aren't like fans of the big programs or, you know, the diehards. But yeah, it's hard to get like super, super excited. Now, obviously I'll watch games and I'll be pretty, you know, into it, but, you know, until ACC play rolls around, it's hard to like really dedicate yourself to it overall. Now this year is a little more interesting because like, I think there's probably a little more intrigue just because this team is such a mystery, and, maybe some worry too, because obviously they've won their exhibitions handily, but they started slow in both those games. I just don't know what to make of this team, as we talked about last week. So in our basketball preview, so I think maybe that actually adds to like some of my interest, because like when we have four seniors and, you know, you're returning three starters or whatever, you know, you kind of know what you're going to be. So when you're playing Cornell in game one, you're like, okay, we're going to win by 35 and these guys will do this. But this game, like, you know, we saw a little bit in the exhibition, we've learned some things. We know Tyus Battle's going to shoot 20 times a game and going to be the focal point. We know O'Shea Brissett looks pretty good so far. We know he can block some shots, but it's still like largely, a brand new experience. So maybe that actually makes the early season a little more exciting. But again, until we start to really challenge ourselves with the meat of the schedule, it's going to be tough to get super ramped up while the football team is still playing competitive football and shooting for a bowl. But we, you know, we are a Syracuse fan, so we do have to pay attention to it because we know where our bread is buttered.
This is very true. But yeah, knowing me, I'm still very much fighting for the real estate on the blog to make sure that football, gets its due credit. I know that it's always a struggle with this blog in particular, just because Sean, me, you, pretty much everyone who's been involved in the site, save like some of the current guys like Ben and James, like we've always been football centric, and like a football centric blog about a basketball centric team just by necessity. Obviously, you know, things shift a little bit, but nonetheless, I do feel like the fight for space is mostly in my head, I think, that versus I do feel like we have a lot of fans who are more football than basketball, and that's probably a larger percentage than the wider Syracuse fan base.
Yeah, I mean, the pod itself is definitely like cultivated kind of an interesting breakdown, because Syracuse football gets overshadowed so much. But college football is more of a year-round sport than college basketball is, so I don't think it's the worst thing in the world.
No, I have to agree there. But yeah, talking Syracuse football and football overshadowing basketball some more. We face Wake Forest on Saturday, as we mentioned, it's at the Dome. Wake is right now a 1-point underdog or a push, depending on which sports book you look at. As we mentioned, Greg Dortch is out. Wake's offense is better. I know Wolford has almost 2,000 yards passing. He has 400 on the dot yards rushing. He's got 24 total touchdowns, just 3 interceptions. He's having a pretty strong season and actually putting up sort of better numbers than Dungy in some ways and worse in others. He's not as dynamic, obviously, but he is a run threat, and he is someone who's able to make plays. Now, whether or not he can do that without Dortch and against a team that's been able to, save last week, been able to stop the run, that's really going to be a big test for them. I think I was worried about Wake's defense. I'm still worried about Wake's defense, but Dan, I don't know how much of the Notre Dame game you watched. The Deacons let up 700. Yeah, well, you couldn't pay me to watch a Notre Dame game that doesn't involve Syracuse, to be honest. But Wake allowed 715 yards to Notre Dame, which is not okay, no matter who you're facing.
I try not to, like, this Notre Dame team is such a freight train, and it's so funny considering what they were last year.
Oh yeah, the 4-8 jokes and everything.
Like, yeah, the 4-8 thing, but also the fact that they, like, we brought up the NC State game last year where they were so dedicated to throwing the ball despite the fact that they were not good, even though they had a good quarterback. This year, like, I guess you give credit to Brian Kelly because he totally reshaped this offense around his talent. Brandon Wimbush is not a great passer at all, but he can run the heck out of the ball. Josh Adams is probably one of the 10 best players in college football. So if Notre Dame steamrolls you, I'm not going to be too crazy about it. That being said, they also allowed, 330 passing yards to Notre Dame. Ian Book came in and was 8 for 8. So that's not ideal, because Notre Dame does not pass the ball well, and they passed for 8.7 yards attempt and 2 touchdowns, no picks. And then they did their normal running thing where they ran for 380 yards and 8.3 yards a carry. So, like, Notre Dame can run the ball like that on anyone. They don't usually pass like that. And Wake Forest, I don't know about this year particularly, but overall, their defensive backfield's generally been one of the stronger parts of their team. And this year overall, I think their passing S&P is pretty strong. They're 30th in the country.
Seven picks. They only allowed 10 touchdowns. Opponent completion percentage is close to like 51%.
Yeah. Now I think part of this might be a little bit inflated by the opponents. They've played Presbyterian, which, who cares? They played early season Boston College, which was like the last two seasons of Boston College. Yeah, before Boston College learned how to this new crazy offense that they have, maybe. They played Utah State, who's, I don't think, very good this year.
Yeah.
They played Appalachian State, who is, fine, but I don't think they're not throwing the ball all over the yard. Florida State, whose quarterback is not very good. Clemson, they lost to, I don't know what Kelly Bryant's, was this the game that Kelly Bryant got, originally banged up in?
Yeah, and, Clemson's done this all year, too, where once they get, a reasonable lead, and that's kind of what helped us against them, I think, is that once they get a reasonable lead, they just kind of, sit on you and coast. They follow the Alabama model.
Right. Then Georgia Tech, who doesn't passing, they don't throw the ball. And then Louisville, who they beat. Lamar Jackson did not have a great game, but he had 330 yards.
Which is still a lot.
And he also ran for 160. So his passing wasn't it wasn't his greatest passing game, only threw for one touchdown, but he still averaged 7.5 an attempt. So a good, okay passing game for him. And then Notre Dame, which threw the ball way better than it usually does. So I'd say how many games have they played? 9. Yeah. So I'd say 7 of their 9 opponents were not giant passing threats. And then Lamar Jackson had a decent game for him, and Notre Dame had a way better game than they usually do through the air, and then their normal destructive running game. So I think maybe Wake Forest passing. This took way too long to explain. Maybe Wake Forest passing defense is. I just realized we spent 4 minutes breaking down every single game they played. Wake Forest passing defense might be a little inflated. So we'll see how Dungy does.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer in general. I know the narrative and the vibe was oh, Wake's better, and yeah, they probably are. But if you look at the schedule versus last year's, this follows a very similar track to last season. Step one, blow out FCS opponent. Step two, beat peer group institution in the ACC. Last year it was Duke, this year it was BC. Step three, beat Sunbelt program. Step four, beat random game against Utah State, because of course you're playing them for 2 straight years. Whatever. You start 4-0, and then you proceed to lose your first ACC game, which they did again this year. So, the narrative that Wake is, really that far ahead of the rebuild process, or that even far away of our rebuild process or anyone else's, we'll see what happens on Saturday. If we beat them, I don't really think Wake is in any better shape right now than they were last year or even the year before when they were 3-9, but they lost, 4 single-possession games.
Yeah, I'd say they're probably better, but they're still,
But, Wolford's leaving. They have, most yes. of their best players are upperclassmen.
Okay, you mean the shape they have going forward, that is it. As we said before, this is a very veteran team. Right. Now, the fact they have guys Dorst, obviously, who's not going to play this weekend, but he's a freshman. So they do have, they have been bringing in some more talent, but with your quarterback leaving, and apparently some of these veterans who have been there forever are going to matriculate,
eventually.
We could see a step back, which you hope to be better than, if Wake finishes with, 6 or 7 wins, you hope to get farther than that before you have that step back. But at the same time, that's such a difficult job that I think overall it's hard to really gripe with what they've done here in the last 2 years.
No, I would take that heartbeat. I'm just more saying just the general vibe of them. So
yeah, I mean they could easily take a step back and then you're not doing a full rebuild again, but it's not you're going to make the jump up to 8 wins if they win 7 this year. because the ACC, like we said, should also probably take another step forward after, you know, an understandable down year considering how good the ACC was last year.
I would agree. I would also, while we're here, before we move on to basketball, actually, before we move on to predictions, then basketball, I don't want to face Notre Dame next year in any way, shape, or form now. And I'm really, really, really glad that that game was moved to, like, the second to last weekend.
Is that late in the season?
Yeah, it was originally, like, a late – it was around, like, a week four.
When all the Notre Dame games have been.
Yeah, it was around a week four, and then they pushed it to a week 12, which –
Notre Dame's gonna be scary. Unless Brian Kelly decides to change their offense again,
or starts coaching the Giants, which
or leaves, which would be shocking at this point.
I mean, the Giants are gonna be looking for a coach in about 4 days.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I thought you were gonna say like at the end of the year. No, it could be any moment.
literally, they're gonna show up to McAdoo's house and fire him like on his couch. Just tell him don't show up to work tomorrow.
His hair is gonna be all disheveled.
It's gonna look exactly the same. Actually, he's gonna have his jackets folded on his couch. It's like, oh, hey, just doing laundry.
I could actually see Ben McAdoo becoming one of those guys who like some college hires for some reason, and he's like Bill Callahan in college. You're like, this didn't make a lot of sense, and it's very evident why this guy is not recruiting anybody.
Oh yeah, who wants to be a retread university?
Oh, Ben McAdoo to Oregon State.
Hoo boy.
Let's do it. Let's see Ben McAdoo try to beat out Oregon for some players.
Christ.
I'm just starting to imagine him like giving like a presentation in a recruit's like living room, and they're just like, what is this guy?
I was hoping for some like weak tie, but no, he's from Pennsylvania.
Ooh, Penn State head coach after James Franklin leaves for some job.
Florida.
Or, like, Florida or, like, the A&M job if someone
That's
is
a worst-case
bounced.
Scenario, actually. I don't want to go down this road, like, for an extended amount of time or, like, any amount of time. But Syracuse fans, you should be rooting for Dan Mullen to get the Florida job because that caused the least amount of repercussions for the rest of the country.
Unless Scott Frost does the Florida and then Dan Mullen just takes Nebraska, in which case it's, like, the same thing.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I think Scott Frost, everyone assumed he was under Nebraska, which makes sense. He's an alum. But
like, why would you want to go to Nebraska?
They've also been talking about this for like 3 years. I don't know if he was interviewed, but he was brought up a lot when they got Mike Riley, which was a bad hire, and everyone knew it at the time. So Scott Frost, apparently Florida is like really keying in on him, and also maybe Willie Taggart, which would open up some interesting issues, which I don't want to get into. But yeah, as long as Mullen and Frost go to those two schools, I think we might be okay. Also, Jim Mora has a huge buyout, and we should hope that that is a deterrent.
Yeah, because UCLA decided to do that dumb thing, like right after he had like a second straight 9-4 season. Decided to extend him because they forgot that like his only division titles were when they went like 6-7, and on technicality because USC was ineligible.
Yeah, and before he actually brought in his own players.
Right. Surprise.
Yeah, who could have seen this? This only happens with, like, half of the hires in college football. including, I guess, I feel like every UCLA hire.
Ever.
Yeah. Football Scoop wrote, like, a just completely hypothetical, like, here's how we, like, half-jokingly think things will play out, and one of their things was Mora getting fired and UCLA hiring Babers. So,
who was coached here before? And by here, I mean Los Angeles, not... I'm not a secret Bruins
John's
fan as well.
John's physical here... Not here in his heart, which is Syracuse University. So let's not have that happen. I'd feel hard. I just completely hypothetically, I would find it hard to begrudge him because that's like a good job. Like a bit much. I feel like UCLA will probably
UCLA is such a dumb job. Like I know everybody knows that
it
from
profiles
afar.
is a very good job.
It profiles a very good job and like. Everybody here thinks the same thing everybody nationally does, that, like, it's stupid that this program isn't good. It also, everyone thinks the same thing about USC that everyone else does. If it's stupid, this program isn't even better. Because it's not hard to sell this place. Like, just step off the plane and, like, drive, like, 2 miles to the beach, and you don't really need to do anything else.
Also, UCLA, you would feel like, has pretty realistic expectations. Like, you beat USC once in a while, you contend for the South once in a while.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Like, I know a lot of UCLA fans, and
from an outside perspective. Oh, yeah. Like they haven't been anything really for a while. They occasionally will flirt with 10 wins, but like you would think that like if you just kind of fought for a Pac-12 title like once in every 4 or 5 years, you'd be in good shape.
Oh, they don't care.
Because they just haven't done that in a long time. No, USC, I get crazy expectations.
No, but UCLA is the same crazy, like similar crazy expectations. They don't care. Like they, and this isn't even to knock UCLA fans because like, you know, all my in-laws are UCLA fans. It's just to point out that like the expectations around UCLA football are very similar, if not worse than the like insane fringe of Syracuse fans that think we should be like 9-3 every season.
That's fair. Yeah. It's also like, I don't know. I'm not too worried about UCLA as a Beavers destination. I know he coached there and that's like a connection, but.
And he's from, not from here, but he spent a lot of time in Southern California as well.
Right. I just don't see like, I feel like we're probably overrating the appeal of hiring Beavers because like, I know he's done a really good job here, and we all know that, and I think it would probably be a pretty decent hire, but I think it's going to be harder for other big schools like UCLA or A&M or whomever to sell, and hey, I'm just like, just to see his daughter goes there, and there's connections to that area. But like, it's harder to sell, like, say he goes 5-7 this year. It's like, oh, we just hired the Syracuse coach with what, like?
10-15 record.
Yeah, like, oh, sweet. Great, thanks.
Dope.
And we know that that's like, a much more of an accomplishment than what it looks like on paper. That's very hard to sell to your fan base.
Oh, yeah, if you told us like, hey, like we're gonna hire Ball State's 10-15 head coach, I'd lose my mind. I wouldn't care. I wouldn't care how we got to 10-15. I wouldn't care if 6 of those wins were in year 2.
They were coming out of like a really bad really bad like legacy hire type deal. You're like, no, I'm not happy that we hired Mike New. Even though he did coach at Tulane, apparently. I still wouldn't be happy about it. I had to Wikipedia Mike New as I brought that up because I was pretty sure he was Ball State's coach still, but I wasn't like 100% sure.
I heard you typing. I'm pretty sure. I'm also pretty sure that Tulane hasn't won a game since I wrote that article about them. Actually, I had like a running spreadsheet for a while. I think every team, just about every team I've written about for the comeback this year is lost the following week.
That's a still a curse. So real,
dude. I wrote about Arizona last week, and they almost came back. That was a lot of fun, actually.
I've long said you were the Mina Kimes of the comeback.
Oh my god! I just wrote about Toledo today.
poor Rockets.
Did you see that score? Dear God.
No, I have the Central Eastern game.
No, they lost 38-10 tonight. My article about Toledo went up this morning.
That's amazing.
Like, I mean, the Bobcats are good, but, like, they're not, like, so good that they should have beaten Toledo by 28 points.
No, that doesn't make any sense.
That's stupid.
Can you start harnessing your powers for good?
Yeah, you know, admittedly, I don't really write about Syracuse as a rule, just because somebody else already pays me to do that somewhere else.
Right.
But, and, like, it's too hard with Syracuse, it's too hard to do the whole, like, national voice versus local voice switch.
That's fair, because it's hard to. I whenever I have to write about Syracuse, it's like the same thing. I have to be like, oh, people don't know this. I have to.
You don't know the jokes. The dank memes are not with you.
Yes.
Anyway, I know we're already running like toward overtime, but
like 8 minutes ago, we said like, oh, let's not go too far into this, and then we just talked about a lot of different things.
all of the different things. All right. Before we move on to basketball, very quickly, just to give a prediction. Dan, do you think we're beating Wake? And if so, by what score?
I keep on projecting us to lose. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, we're 4-5, so it's not like it's done great shakes for me. But we're... I don't know. I don't have a great feeling about the game. I'm going to say we'll win it, just I feel like we need to. And I so something tells me that this team is going to find a way to get to a bowl. It's just too good not to. I'm going to take Syracuse to beat Wake at the Dome. Let's go 31-27.
I was going to say that score. Now I'm not.
A last drive, Dungy rushing touchdown.
That's hopefully... Well, I mean, not hopefully. Maybe hopefully it is as easy as the last rushing touchdown of the Florida State game.
Yeah. I think we're going to have a dramatic, like, really frustrating, but eventually fun game.
As is just about every Wake Forest game, admittedly.
Is every Syracuse game in 2017.
Every Syracuse game ever. For me, I think that Dungy's going to be a little... I think he's going to play. I think he's going to be a little slowed, though. And I think that Wake is going to try to take advantage of that. I think that's going to lead to another slow start, unfortunately. But I think that second half Syracuse is going to be able to do that thing that they do. And I'm going to give them the win here. Give me... Give me 30-26. That's an almost your score, but not quite.
I think this bumped it down 1 point each.
Yeah, that's fine. I was just thinking, like, what's a really dumb way for Syracuse to win this game? And 4 points seem like the dumbest line, because that'll either require, like, you know, us needing a touchdown to win, or us stopping Wake Forest from scoring a touchdown to win. And I feel like that's a natural end to this game.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think this is going to be a close game no matter what happens. I don't see Wake Forest. I don't think either team's going to be able to blow the other one out. And I think Wake is just too consistent that I think this is going to be, I just see us this one coming down to the wire, and we're going to be sweating it out no matter who has the ball last.
Which is unfortunate.
Again, this is not news. We've watched all these games. It's every game.
It's every game, and we're the one with a quarterback who literally has to get, like, carried off the field just about every week lately.
I cannot wait for, like, the retrospectives in Dungy's career. They're going to be so much fun, because what a ridiculous... I mean, we have a whole other year, but what a ridiculous career it's been.
Grape soda, the Eric Dungy experience. Oh, actually, no.
I meant to tweet the Dungy GIF after last night's elections, and I forgot. Now I feel bad, so it's too late now.
Yeah, I think maybe just do grape soda, are you experienced? And then it's just, like, Dungy as LSD tripping Jimi Hendrix.
Ooh, that'd be good.
I would enjoy that. I saw somebody, I really enjoy it after me asking for it. Like, minutes later, somebody mocked up the Dungy Gladiator photo of Are You Not Entertained, which I was...
I need to find that.
I tweeted it out. It's really good. I think I tweeted it from the Noons feed, though. Anyway. Yeah, that was a good one. I was very happy with the Syracuse response to getting that up straight away. I don't know why we hadn't thought of that one before just now, or just today, anyway. But before we sign off here, we won't go into the game itself, because I feel like it's kind of useless to really, like, chronicle these early games too much. Dan, think there's any chance we lose to Cornell?
Maybe. I don't think so. I don't think Cornell's... I imagine Cornell's not that good.
No.
Is Bam Sun playing? Or is he, like, redshirting?
I don't think you're redshirting Ivy's.
Oh, that's true. Ivy Lee doesn't redshirt.
Yeah.
So I hope he plays.
I mean, I'm sure they're going to have him play. They might even have him.
It'd be kind of weird to have him there and just, like, not plan on playing him this year and not play him against his dad at the Dome. So, no, I mean, I have to imagine it will be Cornell. I hope this team starts it off to faster starts. I'm super intrigued. I want to see who plays the rotation. I want to see Frank Howard. I think he's going to be probably the key to this whole thing. If he is good this year, it really changes the whole dynamic of the team. And I'm interested to see if the two centers can continue to play defense the way they did in the exhibitions. Like, if this team can block shots, it gives us something. I'm a little worried about I think we're kind of playing as last year's, like, so far in the exhibitions, I think we're playing on last year's, like, 3-point gunning model when we don't have the shooters for it. So I want to see the offense kind of shift in more of a you know, inside-out direction. But overall, like, we'll see. Guys, it's two exhibition games, so it's not, like, a great set of data to go on. But it's going to be an experiment. I do think everyone brings up, like, the fact that Boeheim's, like, the years the least is expected of him. He seems to rise to the occasion as a coach, and obviously with that Hopkins there, I think he probably has a bit of a chip on his shoulder. So I have, like, muted excitement about this season. And we talked about this a lot last week, but I'm just very interested to see what this year brings, and hope that we can take some kind of momentum into what could be a pretty fun year next year with Basley coming in and Buddy Boeheim coming in and, you know, adding to a very young group.
Agreed. And yeah, I don't think we're going to lose to Cornell. Some of the other games, maybe. I do like the fact that we're facing the Bonnies later, like December-ish. I think that if we, like, had St. Bonaventure's, like, the second or third game, we'd definitely lose that game. Just by way of them having talent and us not being, like, fully, like, cohesive yet.
Yeah, Bonnies are good. I look forward to us beating them by, like, 15, and then Matt Norlander's inbox just...
getting lit up.
Being lit on fire by our angry, irrational fans.
That would be a perfect... I feel like I would make a t-shirt out of that.
It's like the version, remember, I think the 2009-10 season, I remember there was a, this is like before Bleacher Report hired actual people. They had, like, it was just, like, whoever. It was the Wild West Bleacher Report era. And they had, like, a similar thing of, like, they ranked the teams in the state of New York, and they had Siena ahead of us. And obviously we went on to be the number one team in the country for a large chunk of the year. And that writer never really, I don't think he was actual, like, a person that mattered. But he got, like, lit up all the time.
He was never, he was never ever allowed to write about college basketball ever.
No, I think he was, yeah, he was sent to the stockades. his internet was taken away from him. Norlander, his actual college basketball writer, and St. Bonaventure is going to be good, a good mid-major. I don't know about St. John's, whoever knows about St. John's, who we also had ranked ahead of us. But I do hope that we knock them off, because, you know, that'll probably look like a good one at the end of the year.
Yeah, I have to agree. I'm actually now, like, excited for the Bonnies game, and I didn't really care before.
There's always a little extra juice in the Bonnies game, because their fans are, like, weirdly ravenous, too.
Yeah. No,
also they try to injure our players, and that's not the best, but it adds something.
It is. I'm not a big fan. I met one Bonnies fan recently, and I did talk to him about it, and the first thing he was going in about was how the Bonnies were going to beat us this year. I was like, all right.
Yeah.
We'll see you there.
Yeah, like, Syracuse basketball has, like, draws a lot of ire from a lot of fan bases, and the Bonnies are definitely one that we don't talk about all the time, but Bonnies fans do not like Syracuse, and we don't think about them really at all, because we don't play that often, or, like, all the time. It's funny, though. Like, we're probably, like, I know they probably have, like, rivals in their league and whatnot.
No, we're definitely the biggest rival.
We're probably the team that they want to beat the most on any given year. And I guess, like, you could say that about a lot of, like, mid-majors that have, like, a big team on their schedule, but...
UConn.
The fact that we, like, refuse to play there because of their fans, I think they threw stuff on the court last time, and just a lot of stuff like that. Like, the Bonnies, there's, like, a special weird relationship between Syracuse and the Bonnies basketball program. So, yeah, it's always always definitely more interesting than your normal, like, oh, you're playing a random team from upstate New York.
Fair enough. I think that's a good place to end it, actually. A little Bonnie slander while we're here. I feel like we have so many things that I can put in this post to just piss fan bases off now.
Oh, yes. The SEO is going to be so good.
Cannot wait. Dan, thank you, as always, for joining. Much obliged today.
Yes, always enjoy doing it.
Indeed. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. You can be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and go Orange.
Go Orange.